Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Celery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Having a baby is expensive, but what can be even more stressful financially is if that baby is unexpected. Personal finance blogger Bridget Casey is here to tell us about how she budgeted her way through a surprise pregnancy. That some things just don't fit into a two-week vacation, biking through Croatia, doing a road trip coast to coast, volunteering overseas. These adventures don't easily fit into your allotted vacation days. Perhaps a mini retirement could be the solution. We'll learn more about mini retirements from freelance journalist Eric Reed, who's doing just that right now in Cambodia. And it's always wise to have some money tucked away for a rainy day. Yet some question if an emergency fund is actually that necessary. How many emergencies does one really have? We're going to discuss this topic with certified financial planner John DeGooey, whether or not you need an emergency fund. Plus, you want a cabin, cottage, or chalet? We'll talk about how you can get one. Alan Tran from Meridian Credit Union will be here. All that's ahead. Let's get started. Finding out you're unexpectedly expecting means your life and your budget are about to change dramatically. There are a lifetime of financial and logistical challenges that come with adding a child to your life, but with some budgeting, you might be able to find you can afford and manage your surprise pregnancy. Joining us now from Calgary, Alberta, is Bridget Casey. She's the personal finance blogger behind Money After Graduation. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks so much for having me.
I am hoping I hear a gorgeous squawk or gurgle from your daughter, who I understand is providing the silent role in our interview today.
For now, you might take back those wishes.
I will love it. I miss those gorgeous roly-roly days. I want to take us back to the time before she was this gorgeous bundle of joy. You found out you were unexpectedly expecting. What happened?
Well, it was a surprise to me. I had just like wrapped up my first year of self-employment, and I don't know, I peed on the stick and it turned pink right away, and I was suddenly expecting 9 months from then. As you may already know from like the articles and blog posts where I've shared it, I was quite shocked. I had been actively trying to prevent pregnancy, and it still happened, but we made it through, and here we are today.
Oh, my gosh. I can't even imagine. Now, we're talking about this story in the context of personal finance and what one does. How did you begin to navigate what this was going to look like, given A, that it was a surprise, and B, as you said, you're self-employed? There is not the top-up and the maternity benefits and all those kinds of things that people who have a traditional job might expect.
Yeah, that was probably the scariest part. But how I first looked at it is there's essentially two components. There's pregnancy, and then there's your life with a baby and life with your child. So the good thing about an unexpected pregnancy is that you actually have some time to prepare before the child arrives. It's not like a medical emergency or another kind of emergency that happens instantly and you have to deal with it right away. I wouldn't have a baby for like 8 more months. I had lots of time to prepare my budget for that and also to prepare for my maternity leave.
What were some changes that you made right away?
Well, the easiest, or the ones that I had to make right away, were I cut my dining out and my wine budget to nothing. And then I also stopped buying any new clothes because I knew they wouldn't fit in a few months. And I just redirected all that money into a savings account. Like, I actually set one up in my bank account and I named it Baby Fund. And I just started contributing $50 every Monday to that account throughout my pregnancy. And anytime I needed to spend money on a baby expense, whether it was like baby clothes or a stroller, I always took it out of that account.
Now, a lot of people find that period to be quite an expensive one in the lead up to the baby, in part because there's practical things you need to buy, like you need at least a couple of onesies, but also because we can get sucked into all the things that we feel like we should have for our baby to be taken care of in those first weeks and months of life. How did you quell those desires if you felt them?
Well, I'm really lucky. There's lots of babies in my family. So I really just spoke to my cousins and friends that had.
Yeah.
Right now. my cousins and friends that had little ones and asked them what was necessary and what were luxurious purchases. And also the other benefit was knowing so many people that had children is I got a lot of items secondhand. And I think some of the best advice I received while I was pregnant is not to buy too many of those things before the baby is born because they might not like them. Like, I was gifted a baby swing and my baby hated it. And those are like a godsend by most moms. They say, oh, it's the only thing that they'll sleep in. And my baby wouldn't sit still in it at all. So, like, some of the best pieces of advice would be to wait until your baby actually arrives. So if they don't like what you buy them, you can return it.
I completely concur. There's a lot of stuff out there that, like a microwavable, it was a warm guinea pig, and you microwave the inside and laid it next to it. There's just all sorts of crazy things out there that people tell you that you need. I want to ask you about the choices that you made on maternity leave and how you thought that through. You did take some time, but you didn't take the 12 months that some people with a job take.
Yeah, I only took 3 months off, which most people would think is really, really short. But you have to remember that I work from home a lot, or I'm really in charge of my own schedule. So 3 months was the minimum I felt that I could take without letting my business die while still being able to comfortably afford to spend the time I needed with my baby. And then when I did go back to work, I was able to start, like, I started so little. It was like 6 hours a week. I really went into the office two days a week for 3 hours at a time. And I've just gradually increased it over time since then.
What do you think the advantages are of that gradual reentry versus a year off and then all of a sudden get dumped with a bucket of work on your return?
Yeah, I think the way I did it was actually wonderful. And I have quite a few friends now because my daughter's almost a year old and all my mom friends are now preparing to go back to work. And they're going from nothing to 40 hours a week plus their commute. And plenty of them have a lot of anxiety, not only about the workload, but also about leaving their baby, finding a caregiver. And it was nice that I got all those things checked off and I got used to it. Like, I got used to leaving my baby for 3, 4, 6 hours, and I didn't have to go right into like 8 a day. And I think that really helped with the separation anxiety, and it was better for me and it was better for my daughter in that context.
You talked about the $50 a week going into the baby fund. How detailed a budgeter are you, and did you become following this unexpected news?
I track all my spending. So in retrospect, I'm really detailed, but I don't necessarily plan too much forward. Essentially, my rules for myself are I just allocate a certain amount of spending. If I don't have that money, then I can't buy whatever I wanted, which is why that baby fund works so well, because if I wanted an item that was like $150, I would actually have to wait 3 weeks for $150 to accumulate in that account before I could go get it. And that helped me like think about it so I didn't make any impulse purchases. And it also ensured that I wasn't like buying too many things, because if there was no money in the account, I wouldn't go shopping.
So did you sounds like you seriously restricted your credit card use during this time.
Oh yeah.
Was it always this way, or was this new behavior for you? And I ask because one of the lessons that people can take away from your story is you are unexpectedly expecting, but people deal with unexpected expenses in lots of different areas of life. And I think there's something to glean from that regardless of the circumstances.
Sorry, she's just starting to.
I love it.
It really adds to the story. Like, it was not entirely new behavior, only because the year leading up to it was my first year of self-employment, and that was not a profitable, well, it was like profitable, but barely so for me. So I had already gotten used to living on less, and then I kind of just had to keep it going. But personally, it's been a huge, like, drastic lifestyle cut from the way I used to live before that. But at least I was somewhat prepared by being in the self-employed grind the year before.
Wow. Well, Bridget, I love hearing the gorgeous baby sounds, and I really appreciate you taking the time to share your story with us.
Yeah, of course.
Bridget Casey is the personal finance blogger behind Money After Graduation. She was joining us to talk about how to budget when you're unexpectedly expecting.
Your You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Vacation is great, but most of us can't or don't take more than a week at a time. And there can be lots of competition for those precious vacation days. Family events, weddings, home projects. Oh yeah, and the beach. A few weeks of vacation isn't enough, so maybe it's time you took a mini retirement. Here to tell us more is Eric Reed. He is a freelance journalist with The Street, the blogger behind Things Dangerous, and he is currently on a bit of a mini retirement in Siem Reap, Cambodia. Eric, thanks for joining us, and I understand it's, what, 2 a.m. now?
It is. Bruce, thank you so much for having me. I'm out here doing some work. It's the ups and downs of being a freelance journalist.
Tell us about this idea of a mini retirement and what led you to make that decision in your career. What about 5 or 6 years ago when you had a tough conversation with your law firm?
The basic idea behind it is exactly as you mentioned, that sometimes you want to do a little bit more in your life than you can fit into a week or even, 2 weeks off. But the real idea behind the mini retirement, Bruce, and the mini retirement, and I hate to use this term because it's just awful. So please, you and your listeners, try not to groan aloud for me. But it's a chance to find yourself.
Oh, God, I can't believe you just used that phrase.
But the idea is essentially that it lets you do something that never in a million years would you otherwise have the chance to do. When I think of mini retirements, I think, like I mentioned in the article, I think when people think of mini retirements, it's always backpackers and hostels and just sort of sitting on a beach for half a year. But that's not the people I meet. I mean, I've met people who they take their mini retirement and they go teach. I've met people who they take their mini retirement. I think I mentioned the article to hike the Appalachian Trail. I've met one guy in Newington, Connecticut years ago who he was taking 4 months off to work to rebuild an old American Legion post so the local vets could have someplace to get together.
You paid a lot of money to go to law school, I assume. What were the biggest challenges for you in taking this step?
Honestly, walking out the door. And my point being just, I think that by the time you get to, you usually know what you want more than you're willing to admit it to yourself. You come up with all these reasons why this might be a bad idea, that might be a bad idea. But ultimately, when you're at the point that you're unhappy enough with what you're doing, that you would actually be willing to walk away from it altogether or for 6 months or whatever, usually all the objections you're raising in your head are stuff that you're reasons you're finding to object, not things that problems you can't actually solve. So that's, I think, honestly, for me, it was just realizing that it was the right move and the committing to that.
You've argued that it can be a strong professional move, that it gives your resume a little bit of sheen that it didn't have if you were, moving from job to job to job to job like a working stiff.
Absolutely. Unequivocally. Now, look, I'll say from the professional and the career standpoint, because I definitely hope we have time to get into this, the money is absolutely an object. I mean, if you're going to stop working for months at a time, there's a huge practicality question that you got to ask yourself. But from a career standpoint, yes, when you take some time off to go do something interesting and exciting and, fun and even a little bit dangerous for yourself, you become a more interesting person. You become more of the person that you're happy getting up with every single day. And that's something everybody brings into the office. When you sit down, I remember when I was interviewing for law firms, before I actually started, I had worked as a journalist as well. And I spent some time for about 6 months. I would interview soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. And, I'll tell you what, Bruce, not a single one of the firms I interviewed with didn't ask me about that. All of them. Because it was interesting. It made me stand out. It made me somebody that they thought they wanted to spend 12 hours a day in the office with. This kind of thing absolutely makes you stand out, even in places you never thought it would come in handy.
How did you work through the financial implications of taking this break? What are some of the steps that you took? And if you could do it over again, what might you do differently?
Well, the big one, I'd say, like any other major financial commitment, is save. Save, save, save. I mean, I say in the article I saved for 18 months. That's probably even conservative. I think I probably saved for 2 years. And it's, I think the biggest piece of advice I would have is acknowledge that it is, you're making a major financial commitment, and pay attention to all the ways, all the things that you've got to do. You know, don't take 6 months off from contributing to your retirement account. Make sure that that's accounted for. You know, don't count on not getting sick, and so don't budget for health insurance. Make sure you have your line items carefully thought through and accounted for. And then, I mean, the same way you would do when buying a car, the same way you would do when, you know, buying a house, the same way you do when starting a business. Just make sure you put the money aside.
One of the risks I think that people, some people might feel, is that if they take this time off to go find themselves, they may find a person who isn't willing to grind out 60 hours a week in a law firm, or who isn't interested in the big city, and that it may start as a 3-month, you know, build a school in Nepal thing, but lead to a massive change in the arc of their life.
I think that's honestly a best case scenario. I mean, I did it, and I think it's the best case scenario, but I also think you're not going to be at the point where you want to walk away for 6 months unless you want to be doing something different anyway. I mean, if I wanted to stay in Philadelphia and become just like a kick-ass litigator, if that was really sort of where I saw myself 5 years later, I wouldn't have walked away for 6 months. I mean, you don't get better at what you're doing. You get better at a lot of other things. But, you know, I became better at so many other things during the time I took off, but I didn't get, you know, better at securities litigation. I think that it is good because it gives you a chance to make a change, and the odds are pretty good that by the time you want to do something like this, you're ready to make a change anyway.
What advice would you have for people in having the conversation? So they've done the budgeting, they've got a sense of what they would do in this time off. Now they need to tell bosses, friends, spouses, parents, kids, whomever it is. How do you have that conversation? I can imagine for some people it's terrifying.
Well, first and foremost, you don't start by using the term find yourself or find myself.
It was a big mistake in this interview, as I pointed out.
I immediately regretted
it.
I would say you'd have the explanation focused on what makes you excited about what you're going to go do. I mean, if what you're going to go do is teach, or if what you're going to go do is see exciting things around the world, or if what you're going to go do is, you know, I mean, knew a guy once who spent a while being a park ranger. And if that's what you're going to go do for a while, focus on why that's getting you out of bed in the morning. Focus on why that has you so excited. And when it comes to your boss, the same way you would have any other career-related conversation. You know, talk about yourself, but also make sure to the extent you can, you integrate their needs. You want to walk away with everybody being as happy with each other as you can.
How'd you get back into the groove when you were done your mini-retirement that first time?
You know, it's one of the things that makes it a little bit misnamed, because, I spent most of 2012 doing this, but the whole time I wrote. You know, I was writing. I was running a website. I was freelancing. So that by the time I got back, you know, I didn't think I was going to become a freelance writer. I just happened to have, by the time I got home from, you know, from abroad, I had a new career on my hands.
Wow. Did you find yourself?
I'd like to think I at least became a little bit more myself.
That's good. That counts for something. I'll take that.
Right? Plus, it lets me talk to people like you. If I hadn't taken off in 2012, I never would have gotten a chance to meet you.
That is a big perk. It took a while for you to get to that point, but I'm glad that you finally did. I am the best part of many people's day, I'm sure.
Can't argue with that.
Eric, thank you very much for joining us. Have a great time for the rest of your time in Asia, and I hope we speak again.
Bruce, a real pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. Eric Reed on mini retirements. He's now a freelance journalist with The Street, the blogger behind Things Dangerous, and he was in Siem Reap, Cambodia for us today. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolah La, we'll talk about whether or not you actually need an emergency fund. Certified financial planner John DeGooey will be here. And later, more on the travel theme, budgeting for big trips. Financial blogger Barry Choi from The Money We Have will be here. I'm a columnist for personal finance magazine Money Sense. You can find many of those articles at moneysense.ca. Then search for me. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Emergency funds. I'm ambivalent about them. On the one hand, it's good to have a cash cushion in case you, you know, lose your job or something. On the other hand, if you've got a credit card and you've got debt there, you're probably better off eliminating it than saving for an emergency fund. There's lots of circumstances when it makes tons of sense and some when it doesn't make tons of sense, in my opinion. Here to challenge my thinking on the who, what, when, where, and how much of emergency funds is John DeGooey. He's a certified financial planner and portfolio manager at Industrial Alliance Securities. Hi, John.
Hi, Bruce.
How would you characterize your view of emergency funds?
I would also call it ambivalent, but I would also say that it's circumstantial. So a lot of it depends on your income, your cash flow, your tolerance for risk, and that sort of thing as well.
How do you define an emergency? Because one of the things that I think exactly. people overdo is apply that word to things that are completely predictable, forecastable, and savable.
I completely agree, and that's what a lot of people do is they say this was really a bit of a waste, and it's because they used it inappropriately. So I think that's exactly the test. It's got to be something that you did not see coming. If you have a car that needs to be repaired before the summer or needs to be winterized before the snow flies, and you knew that and you've known it all along, that's not an emergency. That's just something that you should have budgeted for. If, on the other hand, someone rolls through a stop sign and puts a ding in your fender that you did not see coming, and that is an emergency. So it's basically, if you saw it coming, it's not an emergency.
What is your rule of thumb on how much people should, in theory, save in an emergency fund? And we can talk about what, you know, some of the variables are that would yeah. increase or decrease that number.
So in many instances, the number is zero. There shouldn't be one. But for those who have an emergency fund, I would say something like 1 to 2 months worth of saving of income is about all you really need. The rule of thumb that many financial planners use is 3%, and I think that's a bit much.
3% of annual income?
So I'm sorry. 3 months of,
3 months.
Of annual income,
right.
And but what I would say is that's really really high. I think 1 or 2 months for most people. If you've got an emergency that takes more than 1 or 2 months worth of income to resolve, then you've got other fish to fry.
What are some of the circumstances in which an emergency fund doesn't really make sense? It's not really required.
You mentioned this off the top of the show. If you have other obvious debts that are attracting a high interest rate, and a credit card debt would be the most obvious example of that, I would not have an emergency fund at all. I think the biggest emergency is paying off
yeah.
high interest non-deductible debt.
There are other ways to pay for emergency expenses, and obviously not great to slap that car repair on a credit card. But
right.
if you've got something like a fully secured line of credit, that may be yeah. a way to ease things.
Yeah, and in fact, that would actually be the way that I would keep score. Let's divide the market into, say, three segments, the low-income earner, the mid-earner, and the high-earner. The low-earner probably doesn't have enough money for an emergency fund because he or she is just paying the bills month to month. The high-earner probably has some equity in a home and can have a fully secured line of credit and would be better off using that line of credit in an emergency whenever it's needed and leaving it in your hip pocket and not using it either way if it's not needed. The people in the middle are the ones that probably need an emergency fund. And I'm going to define the middle as being people who are earning, say, $40,000 to $70,000 as an individual or $50,000 to $100,000 a year as a couple. That's sort of what I would call the mid-market. And those are people who oftentimes are doing better than the really low earners, but they're also not doing as well as some people who have a home. Many of these people in the mid-market won't be homeowners. Depends on where you live in the country and that mm-hmm. sort of thing as well. But as a general rule, it's the people in the mid-market that kind of a cushion, because people in the low end have to just pay the bills and have to minimize those high interest expenses. And the people in the high end have the benefit of usually having some equity elsewhere that they can tap into if needed, and that they simply let it ride if they don't need it.
One of the other factors is income stability. So if you've got, you know, you and your spouse are both freelancers and there's huge volatility, that might be a real reason to have an emergency fund. But if you and or your spouse have a job where the income's stable and you've got a little bit of cash flow wiggle room, then you need less of an emergency fund saved up. Would that be a fair characterization?
That would be fair, but of course it would depend on the emergency. If the emergency is losing your job, then no matter how secure it is, if you lose it, you get a pink slip, then there's a problem there. But back to the story of the car crash, presumably if there's car work that needs to be done, what we haven't discussed is, well, we said, well, what constitutes an emergency? But of course the other problem is, well, some emergencies are bigger than others. I mean, if you've got a tree that falls on the roof of your house and your house is leaking, it needs to be repaired rather urgently. And it's like the old ad says, it costs what it costs. You've got to get it fixed, and that's the priority. Obviously, the more income you have, the more wherewithal you have to withstand it. And you can always, I suppose, in a pinch, get a personal loan, and you can secure it, for instance, against your earning power. So you can just go to someone, and if it's only $10,000 or $15,000 between you and your spouse, even if you don't have equity in a home, you might be able to get a loan that can be at a much more reasonable interest rate than, say, a credit card to pay.
I'm relieved you said 1 to 2 months is sort of your starting point, because oftentimes people say it's like 3, and I've even seen 6 months of after-tax earning. And my concern with that is always that we're setting people up for failure. They just feel like, well, I can't do that, so there's no point in even trying.
Yeah, and the other thing that I would say is, if you have, say, money in a TFSA, you can always tap into it. Now, obviously, if money is in a TFSA and it's invested in equities and stocks, there's always a chance that it might go down temporarily right when the emergency hits. but just to be clear, the emergency is not the stock market dropping. Like, that's not an emergency. That's not emergencies are life events where you actually have to pay for something that you didn't foresee coming along. And but one of the benefits of having money in a TFSA is that you can tap into it at any time at no cost. You take the money out and you can use that. That TFSA can function as an emergency fund as well, which is one more reason why you don't need a traditional conventional emergency fund, because especially if you have, say, some conservative assets and some aggressive assets in your TFSA, even if the stock market takes a tumble, you'll have some,
a bond ETF or maybe even just cash. Maybe even just cash.
That you can tap into then that way as well.
So TFSA container number one. What would be container number two for?
I would not use an RSP. RSPs, as your listeners would likely know, any money that you take out of an RSP is taxable in your hands when you take it out. It adds to your taxable income. And if the emergency is a loss of a job, it's not so bad because you don't have the income. But if the emergency is a tree falling on your house, you're still working, and that's a problem. Plus, you lose the contribution room forever, so I wouldn't do that. If you are one of those people, and again, this is probably the top tier, the people that are high earners who actually have an investment account above and beyond their RSP and or TFSA, you can always tap into that as well. And you might even be able to trigger some capital losses if things are going wrong. You can even turn it into a benefit. But most people won't have that. And it's great to say that you could do that if you wanted to. But I think realistically, most of your listeners won't really have that option.
What about a regular high interest savings account, maybe even at another institution, so there's a lower risk that you're going to touch it?
Sure. Now we're getting into the psychology and compartmentalization of, you have different assets, and this is sort of one of the best ways to ensure you won't touch it, is to say, this is my emergency fund. I've put that money into institution B, and all of the rest of my retirement savings are at institution A. If that floats your boat, then whatever it takes. We're trying to get people to engage in behavior that leads to positive outcomes.
Yeah.
And if you have to do that in order to get a positive outcome, that's unfortunate. But, if that's the only way that you can do it, then it's better than nothing.
How do you ensure people restock it? So there is an emergency. They deplete it.
Yeah.
Needs to be rebuilt.
Yeah. And I think hopefully if it really is an emergency, it's not the sort of thing that recurs. It's the sort of thing that comes, once in a blue moon, and you can restock it slowly. But I would think that, you should try to have it rebuilt within 1 to 2 years, and hopefully at that time. So you just sort of figure out however much you want. And let's say if it's 2 years and it's $10,000, that's $5,000 a year. That's a little over $400 a month. And you should start basically setting up a sinking fund, and $425 every month comes out of your pay and into the emergency fund.
I have an OOPS fund. Have you ever heard of an OOPS fund?
I have not.
It is not for emergencies. It's for when I've been stupid. And the reason I have this is so I can forgive myself quickly because I've been towed or I've just done something just ridiculous. And then I just don't feel badly about it because I say, you know what, $1,000 a year, I'm going to do something stupid. So this is my ability to do that without feeling guilty. Pretty good, eh?
Sure. Yeah, yeah. It's I presume that's fast women and slow horses.
Yeah, neither of those things. Neither of those things. But, you know, people can learn from my stupidity, hopefully. John, thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ruth.
John DeGuey, Certified Financial Planner, Portfolio Manager at Industrial Alliance Securities. Stay with us. Coming up later, we'll take you through the Moolala questionnaire. But next, we're going to talk about how to make your dream of owning a cottage or a cabin a reality. Meridian financial expert Alan Tran will be here. You can keep up with me on Facebook at Bruce Celery Moolala or at Bruce Celery on Twitter. I almost paused for a second there. I started thinking about the cottage. I got distracted. Stay with us. There's more Moolala after the break.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Celery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
The cabin, the chalet, the cottage. Oh, it's the best. We actually bought a teeny tiny little cottage long before we bought our first full-time home. And it's really quite the best thing. Having a second property can be a huge lifestyle boost. But while it's awesome and it's relaxing and all that stuff, figuring out how you're going to pay for it can be a bit stressful, a bit of a challenge. Here to tell us how to make cottage ownership work is Meridian's Alan Tran. Hello there.
Hello.
Now, do you have some exposure to the cottage, cabin, or chalet life?
Definitely do a little bit, yeah, over the years, absolutely.
REMAX put out a study saying almost two-thirds of Canadian millennials would consider buying a recreational property in the next 10 years. What do you make of that number? It seems quite aspirational. Really, is that is two-thirds of millennials going to actually do this?
I don't think it's going to be two-thirds that'll actually do it, but it's definitely a dream. And I mean, dreams can happen. You just got to plan for it.
Real estate prices in many cities in this country have just become ridiculous. How would you encourage people to think about the trade-offs that they will need to make between their place in town and their place in the mountains, on the water, or wherever?
Yeah, so I guess, you know, in today's world, almost everyone's a millionaire with the homes being so expensive.
Yeah.
And so, you know,
provided you don't factor in the what they owe.
That's right. That's right. But, you know, part of the REMAX story actually came with there's two parts to the story. One is the millennial part and one is, you know, going into the older parents part. And when you factor in those two, it's we have the parents who have worked so hard, probably built a great retirement pool. And they're looking to, you know, maybe sell their home that could probably be worth $1 million plus in the GTA, given, you know, they've been paying down their mortgage over a period of time.
Yep.
And now they're, you know, they're using their asset pool to kind of, you know, live a calm life. And then, you know, the millennials get to kind of attach themselves to that and go up for the weekend.
Provided they're nice to their parents.
I
don't know.
Right.
Like, I'm definitely holding the strings. The strings are attached on that one with my kid.
That's right.
So someone listening is like, yeah, I've always wanted to have that second property. What are some of the steps that they would need to take to make it a reality?
So it's interesting. So, you know, before we used to look at cottages as a luxury, right? So you would own your first home and then you would kind of transition and look to, you know, build some savings and then use that savings as down payment for a cottage.
You're going to tell me they're a necessity? Is this the point you're making?
No, but what we're seeing is, you know, individuals are going to a world where they can work from home. A lot of contact centers, you know, we are in a service kind of industry now. And so, you know, it's cheaper for businesses to have, you know, their employees work from home. Here's your laptop. Here's your cell phone and just work from home. And we're starting to see a lot of contact centers do that. Insurance companies are doing it. And what that's allowing people to do is to say, well, hold on a second. I don't need to be in an urban area. I don't need to be in a condo. I can, you know, work the 8-hour shift in a bedroom at the cottage and then, you know, go have a coffee at the lake. And so we're starting
provided there's high-speed Wi-Fi servicing that particular area.
But the tech's
area.
Getting there, right? So it's getting there.
So it seems like the point you're making is the urban-rural decision, they might be able to make it to include a leisure property, if not as their primary place of residence, then maybe as a secondary one, but a smaller place in the city.
Exactly.
What else would you have people consider? They say, Alan, I want a cottage. What should I do?
It should really be part of the financial plan. So what I mean by financial plan is, you know, we hear a lot of times, go see a broker for a mortgage, or if you have money, go see a wealth advisor. But no one really talks about the whole portfolio of an individual. And so, you know, if you have that aspiration, whether you're young or old, and saying, you know, I want to get a cottage, it should really be part of the financial plan, because there's products that help in the early stages of going into a home to really get your dream a reality. And a great example is, you know, a lot of financial institutions now, it's not the old, here's your mortgage or here's your home equity line of credit. You know, Meridian, for instance, has a flex mortgage. And so if you pre-plan going into your first home and you say, you know what, I want to buy a home, but I also want to buy a cottage in the future. How can I make this possible? What we're starting to see is the right products will really help get the individual to transition through.
How do you help people balance what they want with what they can sustainably afford? Because you work for a credit union, so your interests are better aligned with your members than, you could argue, than a publicly traded bank who's trying to report to shareholders.
Right.
So in some ways, it's in your interest to ensure that people take on most debt, as much debt as they can, because that's how Meridian makes some money.
Right.
On the other hand, you don't want people to be unable to sleep at night because they've taken on too much debt.
Absolutely.
So how do you help people find their own balance?
It's really bringing them to reality, right? So everybody thinks that they can afford everything at once. So we live in a world where credit is the end all. So, you know, I want a TV, I'm going to buy it now and pay it off tomorrow. And so the most important thing that I find with individuals is sitting them down and saying, so have you even thought about your budget? When was the last time you looked at your budget? When was the last time you figured out, you know, what you spent last week on groceries and gas and your car and insurance? And so we really take a step back and bring it to the basics of understanding, you know, what do they spend? What's the income coming in? And taking to the basics and then kind of working them through saying, okay, how can we afford it?
And typically, if you were to borrow for a cottage specifically, the down payment requirements are much higher, right?
That's right. Yeah, absolutely.
It's not as simple as the low down payments that you get for a place in the city. Why is that?
There's a lot more risk, right? So, you know, when we look at homes in the GTA, for instance, you put a home up for sale, you have a real estate agent kind of help you sell that home, and then, you know, you're hoping to flip it in a couple of days. Whereas, you know, cottage country, you might not have such a big market for individuals who are looking to buy. And if that's the case, your home sits on the market for that much longer. And it even comes to simple things like running water. Some cottages don't have clean water, running water going to the facility. And so, you know, it's considered high risk, and because of the risk involved, you know, you got to put more on a down payment for that reason.
One of the other parts of the mathematical equation is the operating costs. So how do you guide people to think through those? Exist certainly property taxes, there's insurance, there's all those other things.
Realtor.ca. Honestly, when someone comes in, or if I have a conversation with someone, I first say, so have you even looked at what your dream would be? And so we actually pull it up together and, you know, we do a little bit of research together and we kind of go through and I educate them to say, so let's take a look at the property you're looking for. Let's see what the property taxes are. Let's see if they say, you know, there's clean water, running water. Do you have to bring that in yourself? How is it heated? You know, biggest thing is heating. So a lot of these cottages are electric heating. And so that's costly, running electric, you know, days upon days in the wintertime trying to get the home heated. So
one of the we have a cottage, as I mentioned, and we rent it out when we're not there. It is a super easy way for people to get the cottage experience without owning. Because I actually would say, as a cottage owner, don't buy a cottage.
Right.
It's a terrible
That's
idea.
Right.
We love it and I have no regrets. But what are the downsides to becoming a cottage owner?
The maintenance of the property, right? Yeah. So depending on where your cottage is, if you're on a lake, it's, you know, you probably have a dock. And so the dock needs to be stained and you know, taken care of.
You'll do that. Isn't that a part of the Meridian after mortgage service? Like you just come and do all that stuff for me?
I think people
fix the pump and
we're not there yet.
Oh, okay.
That might be a
all
service
right.
in the future,
all
but
right.
we're not there
okay.
yet.
All right.
Yes.
So other downsides, other things that people should have on the reality check front.
You know, I think the part two is that, you know, how often are you going to be able to get down there? And so, like you said, you rent your property, which is great. But then again, it's, you know, are people taking care of your home as you'd like them to take care of their home? And so if they're bringing 10 of their friends over, you know, are they, you know, damaging your walls? Are they, you know, really taking care of your asset? And if they're not, you're going to be up there fixing things, fixing holes, things like that. And so do you have the time for that on top of you actually wanting to enjoy it?
Is this a part of your dream plan? Are you going to be a cottage owner one day?
I'd rather travel. But, you know, I think cottage ownership is amazing. And that might be a little bit later down the road.
Maybe you rent first. That's my advice.
That's right.
Rent first. Alan Tran, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Alan Tran's with Meridian. We were talking about how to own a cottage. Stay with us. Coming up next, Barry Choi is going to be here to talk about travel budgeting, and we'll take Alan Tran through the Moolala questionnaire. If you want to listen to more Moolala, you can go to our website, moolala.ca, or you can head to iTunes, where you can listen to full podcasts of the show, download them to your phone, subscribe to the podcast version, all that. Stick around. We'll be right back after the break.
Listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
I could talk travel literally all day, every day. And one of the few people I know who could also do that is Barry Choi. He is the blogger behind The Money We Have, and he joins us now to give us his best budget travel tips. Hello, Barry.
Hey, Bruce, how are you?
It was a free tip to Australia when I was 18 that gave me, that I'm sure infected me with the travel bug. When were you hit? What hit you?
You know, I was having this conversation with someone earlier. As weird as it sounds, it was an art history class in college. It was the first time I had really been exposed to anything. This class showed you like the different paintings from museums around the world. But I actually remember the exact moment. It was this picture of Sagrada Familia in Barcelona, and I saw it, and I was like, I had never seen anything like this in my life. And I was just like, I got to go. It took a few years, but like once I got there, it's like I couldn't stop.
I know exactly where you're talking about. We took our, oh gosh, she was almost 2 years old. We spent a month in Spain, and the Dalí was one of the big things. Well, you know, I could reminisce on our trips, or we could give our listeners some helpful tips on how to spend less when they're on their own trips. Mm-hmm. Here's one that I want to talk about because we don't talk about it enough, and that is about currency. Be smart about currency conversion. What should people know, and what are your tips to reducing the hit that can be?
Okay, so currency conversion is something that I could talk about personally all day long, but I'm going to try to keep things simple for our listeners today. So what people got to understand is whenever you're making a charge in a foreign currency on your credit card, the majority of the time you're going to pay a foreign transaction fee, which is 2.5%. So whatever the spot exchange rate is at that day, you pay 2.5% extra. So that includes U.S. dollars, anything that's not Canadian dollars. Now, you can get around that. There's two credit cards that don't have any foreign transaction fees with them. So when you charge it, you're basically paying the spot rate. That's Amazon.ca credit card, and there's also the Marriott Rewards credit card. I personally prefer the Amazon card because there's no yearly fee. But that's just when you're charging credit. If you need cash, that's another story. So what people don't realize, when you go to your local bank, they set the rates, right? So I remember a few years ago, I was going to Brazil and I wanted to get some Brazilian real. And I knew the rate, but I went to the bank, they were marking it up almost 10%.
And this is the bank in Canada.
That's right, just my home. And I understand it's not a common currency, so I don't expect them to have super competitive rates, but 10% was like a lot. And, you know, I was thinking about taking out $1,000 Canadian, and so that's $100 I was paying in fees. So I said, forget that. I did a little bit of research at the time. I didn't know, and I realized that it was cheaper to use local ATMs. So similar to credit cards, I did have to pay that 2.5%, but that was way cheaper than 10%. Now, some people would argue that, hey, you know, you might have to pay a one-time fee. That's true in some cases, but if you max out your daily amount, you're minimizing those fees you're paying.
You can also just tape little maple leaf pins and some maple sugar, and then you're good to go.
It's like a barter system.
It's a barter system. So that's currencies. You advocate traveling with travel insurance, and I'm surprised by this as Canadians. I have had to use the medical system once or twice abroad. Why are you a proponent of travel insurance?
Well, it's just I don't think people realize how expensive medical attention is outside of Canada. We're a bit spoiled. We've got great health care. You know, I go to the doctor, you know, it doesn't cost me anything. But you could sprain your ankle in the U.S., and that trip to the ER or even a doctor could cost you a couple $100s. Whereas if you buy insurance, 2 weeks could last you like be only $100. Now think about a big picture things. Think about like if you break your arm or you get hospitalized, right? All of a sudden you're talking about thousands of dollars. Now if it's something major, right, like a major accident, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars.
But there are certain things that your provincial medical, your OHIP or whatever the equivalent is will cover.
That's correct. They'll cover just the equivalent amount. But in the U.S., those rates are significantly higher, right? So even when you travel outside of the province, so we're based in Ontario. So what it costs in Ontario may cost more in, say, Alberta. And people don't realize that you actually have to pay the difference. Or so when you're traveling within Canada to go to another province, you still have to get travel medical insurance. So again, say you're going to Manitoba, you want to go look at polar bears, and then you get mauled by one. Well, your stint OHIP's not going to
pay. I think you have
that.
Bigger problems if you were mauled by a polar bear than paying extra for the stitches.
Well, exactly. But I think you understand it's like these little things. But the good thing is a lot of us actually have free travel insurance, which may be enough. Many employers offer medical insurance as a standard benefit. This does not include, you know,
getting mauled by a polar bear.
It probably would, actually.
Oh, good to know.
Or accidental death in the worst case. But even like if you use a credit card, a travel credit card, a lot of those have insurance. But like any insurance policy, you need to read the details because you need to find out exactly what you're covered at, for how long, how much. And you want to find out if your dependents are covered also.
Your third tip's around flexibility, both in terms of timing and where you stay. Let's talk about timing. We know this when we look at flights. There, it can be a really big difference in terms of when you decide to fly. What have you found navigating this yourself?
You know, it seems obvious. So we'll talk about the obvious points first. In the summer, it's going to cost you more. Like, we all know that. So if you can fly in, you know, the spring or the fall, you're going to save a significant amount of money. But at the same time, you think about the time of day. I always find overnight flights tend to be a lot. Well, maybe a lot is not the right word, but it'll be maybe $100 or $200 cheaper.
Because they're hideous and they're the worst. And you arrive at your destination feeling like you've been hit by a car.
Depends where you go. Like, when I go to Europe, I prefer the overnight because it's like, yeah, you wake. Well, you're not really waking up. You technically never went to sleep. But, you know, it's also the day of the week. You know, a good example is I just recently returned from Portugal. Now, I flew home on a Friday because it was a $500 difference per ticket.
Wow.
If I flew back on a Sunday. So I was like, all of a sudden, it's like, that is $1,000 between my wife and I. So, yeah, we're like, yeah, our trip gets cut 2 days, but we saved $1,000. It sounds a bit ridiculous, but, you know, it exists. And it's also about where you go to. Flexibility isn't just about the time of day. It's where you go to. You know, the same trip, when I was comparing it to L.A., the flight prices were about the same. But a hotel in L.A. was $250, whereas I could get 3 nights in Portugal for the same price. So in the end, my trip to Portugal was cheaper than going to L.A. It sounds ridiculous, but you're just like, wow, it's like there's so many options. What people don't realize that if you've got set dates and a set location, you're not going to get a deal ever. Right? You've got to be flexible.
Flexibility on accommodation. I was surprised to see you reference hostels because I have not stayed in a hostel since probably the 90s. It was probably $12. Yeah. It was a big dorm and you basically slept with your valuables under the pillow, ready to be attacked at any moment.
Yeah, you know what? Like, I haven't been in a hostel probably in about 10 years myself. But because I write about travel a lot, I'm constantly researching hostels. But even, you know, you look at hostels these days, they understand that they're competing with boutique hotels. Boutique hotels did not exist 10 years ago. So now hostels are creating, like, you know, great amenities where everyone's going to get Wi-Fi. You know, you've got art all over the walls, but the rooms are better. You're not going to find those 16-bed dorms where it's one washroom shared by 200 people anymore, right? You know, a standard bed configuration might be 4 to 6, and each individual room has a private washroom. So if you think about it as a family, you could rent an entire dorm, and it would be significantly cheaper than getting a hotel. Now, that's one thing. There's hostels. Everyone knows about Airbnb. You know, I remember 5 years ago, Airbnb was a new thing, and everyone's like, why would you want to stay in someone else's bed? It sounded like the creepiest thing ever. And now, like, everyone knows what Airbnb is. Like, everyone's into the sharing economy.
You have taken your baby moon. Your wife is pregnant. You're going to have a kid, what, in July or something. Can I extract a promise from you? Here's the promise I want you to make. You will continue to travel with your child.
Oh, yeah. It's funny you say that. People, we spoke to our friends and we were going to Portugal and they're like, oh, you're totally the type that's going to still travel with the baby. I was like,
oh, yeah.
I'm already thinking like early 2018 when my wife's almost getting back to work. I was like, oh, yeah, we can totally take a you know, hopefully a month long, maybe a little bit longer.
Nice.
And travel. There's nothing that's going to stop us.
We will see you at the departure gate. Very Choi. Thanks very much.
No problem.
Time now for the Moolala questionnaire. Our answerer today is Alan Tran. He is with Meridian Credit Union. And Alan, I want you to answer the first thing that comes to your mind.
Okay.
All righty. How would you describe your money personality?
I'm a saver.
Have you always been a saver?
Always.
When do you, if you think back to the very, very beginning, what is the first moment you remember saving money?
I used to work at Woody Woodchuck's, which was like a Chuck E. Cheese.
Oh, great.
And I
how
remember,
much Woody Woodchuck chuck?
Right? And I remember I wanted to buy my first car, and so that was my first savings experiment. It was, you know, how quickly could I save to buy my first vehicle?
And how long did it take?
It took 3-4 months because I got a used car. So yeah. 3-4 months.
What kind of car was it?
It was a used Infiniti.
Oh, that's yeah. pretty fancy.
Yeah, $1,000. I got there pretty quick.
$1,000. How long did you keep that car for?
It only lasted a year, and then it was done. Yeah.
It was done. But still, $1,000 well spent.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who was your money mentor growing up?
It would have been my parents, for sure. So I think finance really comes from your parents, and my parents really instilled the, you want a car, you got to save for it. Understand the value of money. And it really taught me lessons. When I was, you know, 21, I owned my first home.
What, you owned your first home?
I owned my first home.
Wow. How did you save for the down payment?
Working. Parents helped a little bit. But, you know, it really was, you know, the understanding of that savings and what you want to use it for, right? And so instead of going out every weekend and spending $100 on, you know, drinks and things like that, if you think about it, you spend $100 to $200 a week. In 52 weeks, that's, you know, $10,000 right there and just going out.
What do you think led you to a financial goal of buying a home versus you were going to, you know, open up an RRSP and start cranking on that one? Both would be virtuous actions, just different.
I think, you know, at the time, investing in a home and, you know, my first home was in Mississauga. And so I got lucky with, you know, I looked at that home as my asset and I knew that I kind of maybe wanted to flip it. And so, you know, when we got into the home, we fixed it up, spent a little bit of money in paint, things like that. And then the market just took off and then we were able to.
How long did you hold it for?
A year and a half. Yeah, a year and a half, 2 years.
And how long have you been in your current place for?
So actually only a year because we bought.
Are you a flipper? Do you have a reality show on HGTV?
Right. So no, it just started with one. And then, you know, you get a little bit more savvy in taking care of your home and how to paint and how to, you know, fix drywall and things like that and make mistakes. But then you start to see that, you know, you're able to kind of move into another. So actually now the second home we bought after we had the Mississauga home, we're actually renting that one now. And then we bought another home. So I have a rental property and I have my own property.
What is one of your guiltiest spending pleasures?
Gadgets, electronics. It's, you know, I love, you know, when I was in high
school. What's something you bought recently?
I'm all into, you know, new TV, like TVs now are awesome because they're smart TVs and things like that. So I just bought 2 TVs from Costco. Yeah.
From Costco. All of a side of a cow and 2 televisions.
It's dangerous
and
there,
14
yeah.
pairs of jeans.
Yeah, right?
Wow. What is one financial behavior you're still working on, aside from not spending so much at Costco?
Yeah. Honestly, I think it's just, I think it's like the majority of individuals. I think it's, I hate seeing a statement come in from a credit card company saying I owe a balance. Like I try to clear everything as much as possible. And I know some individuals say, well, you know, use your credit card and you get points and then pay it off right away. I just don't like that mentality of like, well, what if I forget? I don't want to pay 20% even on a 1 month if I forget to pay, you know, the minimum balance or, you know, the full balance. So I use my debit card as much as possible and just make sure things are clear.
What does financial freedom mean to you?
Being able to travel. Like for me personally, I want to be able to see the world. And so for me, it's getting out there and that's how I want to use my money is I want to be able to travel the world and see different things.
If I had a globe right in front of me and I spun it, where would you slam your finger down? What is the destination of choice that you would go to above all others if you were not financially constrained?
So I think I would be going to Vietnam. And the reason being is that's where my dad's from.
Yeah.
And I've never been there. And, you know, I really want to see, you know, where he came from and his roots and understand, you know, what he had to go through to get to Canada. And so I want to go there. Yeah.
Fantastic. Alan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Alan Trans with Meridian Credit Union. That's our show for today. What'd you think of it? We'd love your feedback. Ask at moolala.ca is our email address. We're on the radio today, but I also do a lot of TV. If you want to tune into CityLine, you can go to cityline.tv and then search for my name. You'll find lots of money-oriented segments. Also, we have a couple of books. I have a couple of books. Moolala, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things With Their Money and What You Can Do About It. It is available in online stores all over the place. Thanks very much for joining us. Have a great day.